The Horse and His Boy is a very, very dense book. It's full of meanings right through the whole book.
Yeah.
I mean, there are sequences which just all blow your mind if you stop and think long enough.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world.
And can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news,
this is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. This is Brian Carnell, also known as Glumpuddle, and my guest today needs no introduction. On the phone, I have Douglas Gresham, the stepson of C.S. Lewis. Mr. Gresham, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and how are things in Malta these days?
Finally, we're getting some warm weather. I mean, we've had the longest winter I can remember here. And it's finally come out sunny today. The birds are cheeping in the trees. So things are good in Malta right now.
Fantastic. Good to know. And all right, well, turning to today's topic, one of your jobs at the C.S. Lewis Company is being a guardian of your stepfather's work, and that includes supervising any adaptations. And the Logos Theater in Taylor, South Carolina, is currently developing and raising support for a stage version of The Horse and His Boy. And I understand you've read the script, so what was your reaction when you read the script for The Horse and His Boy stage play?
Well, I know that Nicole is going to say, and Nicole, of course, is the director and writer of these plays. When I hear that she's about to send me a script, I always get excited because I know it's going to be good.
Mm.
I mean, I've seen and evaluated and commented on several of her scripts. So now, I mean, we did years ago The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was excellent, and then of course they did Prince Caspian, and a beautiful the whole production was beautiful. I mean, the way it was put together. The way she concentrated on getting the right messages from the book in the right way into the dialogue and every other thing, everything you could think of, was just done well in that production.
I say, Peter, isn't this the armor that you wore in the great tournament in Lone Island?
Yes. Do you remember the dwarf making this for me?
How could I forget?
Well, it's getting late. We better take the things we have, and our special things, our tools given to us by Father Christmas, and then be on our way.
And I first of all, I read the script, as I do all the play scripts that are done for Narnia,
and Jack's
other works too. And The Horse and His Boy, I came up with, I think, after reading it through about three times, I came up with, I think, three or four maximum very, very mild suggestions. So she just got it right. And Nicole Stratton is a very, very talented young lady. As her husband's a talented guy too. Noah, he's very with it. So I was able to write back to them and say, come on guys, this is great. Let's get on with it. But here are a few suggestions. And I'm very convinced that when they do the play, it's going to be a spectacular work of theatre. I have seen this book done before on stage by another Christian theater company in Manila in the Philippines.
Right.
And they too are very, very particular about getting it right. And again, I vet their scripts for them and they fly me over and I go through rehearsals with them as well and so on.
Yeah.
And it was, again, that was a very, very good production. But I don't think it's going to be any better than what Nicole and Noah are putting together. In fact, I think they're going to be on level pegging with each other because they're both brilliant, in my experience. And I've done an awful lot of this theater work all over the world. And these two production companies, Trumpets Theatre in Manila, and of course the Logos Theatre, just stand out as being, you know, a step above everybody else, if you know what I mean. Particularly in the lower, in the lesser categories of theatre production. I mean, when you get to the West End or you get to Broadway or wherever, you're liable to see some dramatically good stuff on any play they do, because they're full time professionals. They've been doing it for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. Really, those theatres have been running. But I believe that these two, particularly the Logos Theatre, would do very well in the West End, or for that matter, on Broadway.
And obviously, anytime you take a book and translate it into anything else, whether it's a radio drama or a stage play or a movie, some changes are required in order to make that transition. But in your opinion, what are some of the key themes and ideas from The Horse and His Boy that have to be preserved in any faithful adaptation?
Well, there are so many, we'd be here all day.
Right.
As I say, the Horse and His Boy is a very, very dense book in terms of what it contains in ideology, what it contains in display, in theatricality, and so on. It's full of meanings right through the whole book. I mean, there are sequences which just all blow your mind if you stop and think long enough. First of all, for example, we have the problem of Shasta with his I suppose evil is too strong a word, but his very unpleasant adopted father, who pulled him out of a boat when he floated ashore one day many years before. And the whole relationship that goes on of how this man has enslaved the boy and so on, that's something we need to think about in today's world when, you know, slavery is becoming more and more common around the world and human trafficking and so forth. So you start right there with an enormous smack in the head about, wow, you know, this is unbelievable. But we know now that it really is going on all around us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you get the Tarkan, Rishta Tarkan, who tries to buy him. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he walks into a very sagacious and very foolish at the same time, which is kind of an odd mixture, horse in the stable who talks to him, the Tarkan probably would have bought him, and his life would have been an absolute misery from then on.
Mm-hmm.
Many people have been saved by horses in a variety of different ways, but nobody's ever had one talk to him, I don't think.
Not to my knowledge,
Except,
no.
Of course, Balaam went through that. An ass talked to him. But, that again sets up a whole different attitude, a whole different way of looking at things. Because one of the things that Jack hated most about the First World War, I mean, he hated all, when he was in the trenches, he hated the whole thing, of course, but one of the things he came back with the deepest sorrow and most anger about was the slaughter of horses that took place in those wars.
Mm.
People forget all about the horses. They just remember that millions of people, millions of men died on those battlefields. Well, millions of horses did on both sides too. And Jack took that somewhat to heart. It was something that really disturbed him. He was fond of horses. So The Horse and His Boy is, I think, probably something of his way of paying a tribute to the equine world, in a sense. So there's that. I mean, it goes on step by step right through the whole book. We could be here for days talking about it.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten through the first chapter, and there's so much there.
Exactly. We haven't got anywhere yet. But I think also that the scenes with Aravis and the relationship that develops between them initially is extremely well worth looking at. Because, I mean, it's recently been demonstrated and actually proven, I believe, that children at school learn more from their peers, good and bad, than they do from their teachers.
Hmm.
And the result of that has been people all over America and all over the world now are waking up to the fact that good homeschooling is infinitely better than even the best of schooling.
Hmm.
It's kind of interesting that that's becoming known around the world nowadays. And I think that the fact is there to be read that the schooling that takes place between Aravis and Shasta and, of course, the two horses, Huynh and Bree, that sort of educational process that is going on when they talk around the campfire at night, when they run into the lion and all of that, is hugely valuable for us to understand, not just them. And this is what Jack does with all his books. He's sneaky. He teaches us in the greatest of fantasies,
mm-hmm.
right through his writings.
Mm-hmm.
The scene I think that I love enormously is when Shasta arrives back at the hermit's place and suddenly appears in armor and royal robes and stuff and is very apologetic about it. That's important. But there are so many sequences and scenes throughout this book which are so desperately needed in the world today. For example, one of my very favorites, you ask me my favorite, this will be it. The scene where Shasta has lost control of his ordinary horse, not a talking horse that he's actually riding. And the horse is plodding along, and Shasta doesn't know how to make it go any faster and so forth. And he is walking, the horse is walking along the edge of a 1,000-foot precipice. And it's misty, it's foggy, and Shasta can't see this. But while they're doing this, this voice talks to him. Because it's Aslan, who is walking on air between the precipice edge and Shasta. He's mm-hmm. somewhere either, he may be walking on air over the precipice edge, we don't know. But what he's there for is to prevent Shasta from falling over the edge and descending into oblivion in the
wow.
the rocks below.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, all of our lives, you, me, and everyone else on Earth, all the time, has that same character with a different name walking beside us in the fog of our lives to prevent us from falling down into hell.
I was the lion, yeah.
Yeah. And it just I mean, the book is so rich, it's impossible for me to go right through it. We'd be here for a week.
Right.
But you're getting the idea, I'm sure.
Yeah, but before we started recording, we started talking about how underappreciated the books are. I think people, they come across some of the surface level themes and ideas, and they think, oh, that's it. And I'm hoping that adaptations like this can encourage people to take another look at it and say that there's more there than meets the eye initially. It's worth taking a second look.
I think they certainly do. I think they really do, because one of the differences between reading a book and seeing a stage play, or seeing a movie for that matter, on a movie we got all crash, bang, wallop, lots of violence and sex and everything, and everybody knows it's as fake as a $3 bill.
Mm-hmm.
On a stage play, what you're seeing happening on the stage is really actually happening right there before your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, admittedly, the actors are playing the roles of certain characters, from, in this case, the horse and his boy, but they are actually doing what they're saying, and they're saying what is said in the book, and so on. So they're real. They're not fake. They're not imitation. They're not CGI. They're not any of that action movie stuff. These are real characters portraying real events to them, and supposedly to the audience, which took place in a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's desperately important.
Yeah. And of course, The Horse and His Boy is actually dedicated to you and your brother. And one thing I've always wanted to ask you about is the fact that, you know, The Horse and His Boy turns out to be the story about two brothers. Do you think that's the reason that your stepfather ended up dedicating the book to you and your brother?
Actually, I very much doubt it. And there are many reasons for this. One is that my brother was a paranoid schizophrenic, and a dangerous one, a violent paranoid schizophrenic. And he tried very hard to make everybody in the whole of the kilns, when we lived there, as miserable as possible. He was an unpleasant boy to deal with and became an unpleasant man to deal with. So I know that Jack couldn't help, but Jack had this amazing ability, as I said in something I did for HarperCollins a couple of days ago, astonishing ability to create, or not create, it's the wrong term, but to invent characters for use in his books, whom he would later meet in real life. He was very careful not to portray people he already knew, because he felt that would be unfair to the people concerned. But occasionally he would write a character who would then suddenly appear in his life from out of the blue, as if God was saying to him, you see, you got it right.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother was one of these characters, and he appears in a couple of different places. For example, Eustace, before his resurrection as a human being, rather, not resurrection is the wrong term, but his undragoning, shall we say.
Yeah.
Was the epitome of my brother. And Jack had never met him when he wrote the book.
Hmm.
And Shasta both Cor and Corin, shall we call them, both exhibit certain sides of my personality, the good and the bad.
Interesting.
So I don't think, and Jack hadn't met us, but before when he wrote the book, he dedicated it to us because my mother asked him to, I think, I don't know.
Okay.
But it was before he'd ever met us.
Obviously, I know you take all of your stepfather's work very personally and you're very protective of it. But the fact that the book is dedicated to you, does that make you feel even more protective of it at all in some ways?
No, I don't think so, actually. I had to think quite a lot. I mean, I was told that you were going to ask me something like that. I had to think quite a lot about whether it really did or did not. What I feel about my stepfather's works, that means all of them, whether they're fiction or academic or whatever, is that my stepfather took me in, and my brother, but me in particular in this case. My brother died, incidentally, a few years ago. But so I am the last dinosaur of that particular species, by the way, as Jack would put it. I'm the only man still living who really knew and lived with C.S. Lewis and Joy Davidman and Warren H. Lewis, for that matter, too. But what my attitude is because Jack was so forbearing with me when I was being a ratbag kid, and because he was so helpful and so loving to me when I needed someone more desperately, I think, than I have ever done before or since, and he was there for me when I needed him, and he and I bonded together during the time after my mother's death, a short period before Jack himself died, and because he was so good to me, I feel that I owe him a moral responsibility to do my very best to take care of and look after the books and the works that he left behind. There have been lots of people who have tried to trash them one way or another, and I'm afraid I do get kind of shirty with them. And sometimes I write them clear and rather forceful letters, but no bad language, just pointing out that they're making a complete idiot of themselves in some instances. Often people try and just misunderstand, and then I do my very best to try to explain where they've gone wrong. and so forth. But I think I've inherited this moral responsibility to do the very best I can to make sure that when something written by Jack is converted into a stage play or whatever, that it is as close to the book as possible for a stage or a film production. I don't always win these battles, of course, but I fight them as hard as I can. And also that the messages behind what he's writing do come out and are exposed to the public, and so that people learn what Jack is trying to teach. So I think it's not so much that I'm protective of them, it's just that I think I have a moral responsibility to be their guardian and to fight for them.
Well, Mr. Gresham, thank you so much for everything you do protecting the legacy of your stepfather. We really appreciate your efforts.
Well, thank you. It's a duty I regard as a duty to Christ and a duty to Jack's memory. And quite frankly, I enjoy doing it a great deal. And I wouldn't really want to be doing anything else. I mean, I've done a lot of things in my life, but this has been probably the most emotionally and intellectually rewarding work I've ever done. So
great.
I'm very glad to be doing what I do.
Great. And Narni Weber, as always, really appreciate hearing from you. So thanks for being on the show today.
Well, can I make another comment before you go?
Sure.
The one other thing I'd like them to pay attention to is PBS's looking for The Great American Read.
Yes.
And I think that the book they've stipulated for C.S. Lewis, by the way, is the one-volume collection of the Narnian Chronicles.
Yeah.
And I think it would be such a great, great boon to everybody if America began to realize again what these books are really worth. So if anyone on Narnia Web wants to, you know, get stuck in and vote for that book, please do.
I'm pretty sure we'll find at least a few people who will.
I'm glad to hear it.
And we will have a link in the description if anyone wants to go vote for that. Definitely do that. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
That was Douglas Gresham, the stepson of C.S. Lewis and co-producer of the Chronicles of Narnia films. Even if you don't think you'll be able to make it to a show, I hope you'll still consider supporting the Logos Theater stage production of The Horse and His Boy, which opens next March. These stories had a big impact on my life, and I want to vote with my money and support the artists that really get it, and I think the Logos Theater really gets it. They're not paying me to say that. I've just seen their work, and I want to get the word out. It's good art, and it's Narnia done right. To donate to their production, go to GoFundMe.com/The Horse and His Boy. The link is in the description. You've been listening to Talking Beast, a podcast at NarniWeb.com. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@NarniWeb.com or glumpuddle@NarniWeb.com. By the way, we're also on Twitter @NarniWeb. A new episode is posted every 2 weeks. We'll be back on June 5th, continuing our discussion of The Horse and His Boy book. Until then, further up and further in.